You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, November 16th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Bill Black, former government regulator, on the latest Bank of America scheme to rip off the United States, and just our lack of prosecution of Wall Street in the wake of the financial meltdown as opposed to the savings and loan crisis. It's a pre-taped interview, some of which aired on Ring of Fire a week ago. And we're going to have an abbreviated show today, folks, as we are preparing for our epic 12-hour show tomorrow, celebrating the one-year anniversary of the Majority Report relaunch. And we have an amazing lineup, and we're adding to it as we speak. Well, not as we speak. We're taking a moment to do the front half of this program today, and then we will continue to add to it. But tomorrow on the show, Matt Taibbi, Fran Lebowitz, Chris Hayes, Marcus Melitzis, Janine Garofalo, Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald, Bill Scher. Hopefully we'll have others. We may have a libertarian or two on. And, of course, we'll be taking your phone calls. We're going to be talking to Jesse LaGreca. We'll be talking, hopefully, to Jeff Smith, a longtime Majority Report listener and member of the media team at Occupy Wall Street. We'll be talking to more and more. And just almost perfectly timed. Could not have done this better. But over the past year, it's probably a little bit more than this, actually, by probably even maybe six figures, because we didn't have the same data recording. We made some switches over the year, but sometime today we will have served over 1 million free. It's not including the probably, again, six figures of members podcast, but 1 million free podcasts since we started counting. Just a coincidence, but a happy coincidence. It's been a quite a year, and we will talk about that more tomorrow. But I just wanted to give you an update. Obviously, yesterday after the program, as it stood when the program ended, the city was in violation of a court injunction from evicting the occupiers at what is formerly known as Zuccotti Park, now Liberty Square, from their occupation. We spoke about that extensively yesterday. We were anticipating a court order as of 3 p.m. It didn't come in until about 5 p.m. And the court ruled in favor of Well, I guess it's accurate to say in favor of the city and the owners of Zuccotti Park. The relevant part of the decision from Judge Michael Stallman read in part, to the extent that city law prohibits the erection of structures, the use of gas or other combustible materials, and the accumulation of garbage and human waste in public places, enforcement of the law and the owner's rules appear reasonable to permit the owner to maintain its space in a hygienic, safe, and lawful condition and prevent it from being liable by the city or others for violations of law or in tort. It also permits public access by those who live and work in the area who are intended beneficiaries of this zoning bonus. So it basically came down to tents. Not allowed to put up tents, which supposedly permanent structures. Of course, I think it was a National Lawyers Guild member who said, well, the idea of them being permanent sort of moot, they were torn down. They're not, you know, the idea that you can actually take them down means that they're not permanent. So it's unclear at this point what legal action is going to follow. People did sleep in the park last night. Not many, but some, according to the New York Times. There were a few dozen protesters who remained in the park. They slept sitting up or didn't sleep at all, but they stayed in the park over through the night. At Judson Memorial Church across the street from Washington Square Park, 60 protesters were sprawled out on blankets in the church lower parish hall. It's according to a volunteer there. There was no any type of friction last night, as far as we know, at the park. And there was a massive General Assembly last night in the park, and was rather inspirational. I mean, I have said for quite some time that the occupation was incredibly important to maintain, and qualified really only by the idea that if it's not allowed, it's not a question of the occupiers all sort of quitting and losing their determination. They are figuring a way to occupy the park within the restrictions that have been imposed upon them. I think there are further legal questions to be answered here as to whether or not the idea of a 24-hour occupation of a space is not free speech. This is not being done recreationally. That is not the primary purpose of it. It is to send a message. It seems to me it's just as obvious that occupying a space and everything it takes to do that over the course of 24 hours or an extended period of time should be just as legally protected as money is as a form of speech. Because money, my understanding is, and we'll get somebody on maybe to talk about these legal issues tomorrow, but if money is a mechanism in which to provide its spender speech, I don't understand how a tent is not facilitating that same desire to send a political message. But maybe there's an attorney who can set me straight, or maybe this is an issue that that needs to be resolved. There was a statement put out by OccupyWallStreet.org, and this came yesterday before the the final ruling by the judge. But it went on to say, a massive police force is presently evicting Liberty Square, home of the Occupy Wall Street, for the past 2 months, and the birthplace of the 99% movement that has spread across the country and around the world. The raid started just after 1 a.m. Supporters and allies are mobilizing throughout the city, presently converging at Foley Square. Supporters are planning public actions for the coming days, including occupation actions. 2 months ago, a few hundred New Yorkers set up an encampment at the doorstep of Wall Street. Since then, Occupy Wall Street has become a national and even an international symbol, with similarly styled occupations popping up in cities and towns across America and around the world. A growing popular movement has significantly altered the national narrative about our economy, our democracy, and our future. Americans are talking about the consolidation of wealth and power in our society and the stranglehold that the top 1% have over our political system. More and more Americans are seeing the crises of our economy and our democracy as systemic problems that require collective action to remedy. More and more Americans are identifying as part of the 99% and saying enough. This burgeoning movement is more than a protest, more than an occupation, and more than any tactic. The us in the movement is far broader than those who are able to participate in physical occupation. The movement is everyone who sends supplies, everyone who talks to their friends and families about the underlying issues, everyone who takes some form of action to get involved in this civic process. This moment is nothing short of America rediscovering the strength we hold when we come together as citizens to take action to address crises that impact all of us. Such a movement cannot be evicted. Some politicians may physically remove us from public spaces, our spaces, and physically they may succeed. But we are engaged in a battle over ideas. Our idea is that our political structures should serve us, the people, all of us, not just those of us who have amassed great wealth and power. We believe that is a highly popular idea, and that is why so many people have come so quickly to identify with Occupy Wall Street and the 99% movement. You cannot evict an idea whose time has come. And so it goes. Tomorrow has been planned for some time. On the two-month anniversary, I think it will be day 64 of the occupation, there is planned an International Day of Action. In New York City, there will be an attempt to shut down Wall Street at 7 a.m. Occupiers will gather in Liberty Square at 7 a.m. before the ring of the trading floor bell. This is from OccupyWallStreet.org. And there, before the stock exchange, we will exchange stories rather than stocks. At 3 p.m., occupy the subways. We will start by occupying our blocks. Then throughout the five boroughs, we will gather at 16 central subway hubs and take our own stories to the trains using the people's mic. In Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan, you can, in Staten Island, you can get information on OccupyWallStreet.org. And then at 5 p.m., thousands of people will gather at Foley Square, just across from City Hall, in solidarity with laborers demanding jobs to rebuild this country, infrastructure, and economy. A gospel choir and a marching band will also be performing. Portland has actions planned. I imagine there are other cities that have actions planned. You can go to their websites. In Spain, in Belgium, in Germany, there are already actions planned. It should be quite a day tomorrow. And as I've also said over the past month or 2 months, that I think we're going to see over the next couple of months sporadic and consistent actions that are going to lead to something really big in the spring. I think as time goes on, it becomes clearer and clearer that the real power citizens have in this fight to make America a more democratic country, to make it a more economic just country, to fight back against incredible student debt, to fight back against the lack of health care, to fight back against stagnant wages, to fight back against massive joblessness, to fight back against a society that measures the success of the economy based on the success of the wealthiest among us, as opposed to the amount of wealth all of us share. I think American citizens are going to realize that their real power lies in withholding their labor. And I think that's going to culminate in perhaps a series of smaller general strikes and a big one come spring. And I think for those occupations that continue, and there have been evictions across the country, and we now know this was a concerted effort between mayors from different cities with the help of both the FBI and the Homeland Security in advising. Remember on Black Friday, we'll talk about this more in the coming days, but the day after Thanksgiving, to go down to your local occupation and give them what you can for them to help to maintain their presence. There was just a huge, huge General Assembly last night. And apparently spirits are in New York City, and spirits are still high, as well they should be. The intensity and the determination of people will not be thwarted by the fact that our billionaire mayor and his billionaire friends, maybe they're millionaire friends, decided that the best way to silence people was to keep them from occupying that space. I just don't think it's going to work. And meanwhile, in Seattle, Seattle police pepper sprayed, apparently, a pregnant woman and an 80-year-old woman. Pretty stunning. At one point, one wonders if some of these cops are just going to say, like, I just can't do this. I just can't do this. Hopefully, there was, certainly not the majority of police, but there was certainly a lot of police, at least in some of these videos I've seen, that seemed to really enjoy their jobs yesterday, and it's sad. So part of Occupy San Francisco camp was raided. I believe over the course of the night, 7 arrests and 15 camps taken down. And like I said, about 60, like I said, there was 29 activists, 30 activists. We're not sure exactly how many spent the night in Liberty Square in New York, but it's discouraging, but at the same time, it just simply means that there is going to be more organizing that's going to take place, not necessarily in Zuccotti Park, although there are all sorts of plans that are floating around about how the occupation can continue there. And we shall see. But one of the reasons that people are occupying is because it seems that the banks and the financiers are completely above the law, that we are not seeing the administration or Congress take any actions to curtail the banks and the investment banks from the same things that crashed our economy before. And Bill Black, now a professor and a former government regulator who helped in the prosecution of literally hundreds of people involved in the saving loans crisis, has been speaking out intelligently and consistently as to the lack of prosecutions following the wake of the 2008 financial meltdown, and also on the chances of the next financial meltdown, as these too-big-to-fail banks are actually bigger now. And so this is an interview I did with him about a week and a half ago. We've extended footage, extended track. So don't forget tomorrow, folks, 11:30 a.m. Eastern to 11:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll have some comedians. We'll have some writers, some talkers, some bloggers, some of my favorites, maybe some that haven't been on. Hopefully we'll have some arguments with some libertarians just because they seem to be the most excited to. I mean, what are you going to argue with a Kane supporter for? And it should be fun. I'm hoping that a lot of you will call in. A lot of you will listen live that don't get the opportunity to listen live because you've got to work during the day. You can check it out at 7 p.m. at night or listen to it at work. All right, so here's that interview with Bill Black, and we will sign off after this interview. We will see you tomorrow. Don't forget, folks, it is your support that keeps this show alive. Originally, when we were talking about this, I'm going to take another second here. Originally, we were talking about this 12-hour show. People were telling me, like, you'll be able to get a lot of members from this. And I hope so, but, you know, I haven't quite marketed it that way or marketed it. Period. I got to send out an email blast to everybody to tell them. And I want to remind you, we are an award-winning podcast. An award-winning podcast that has served over a million free podcasts. So if you're not a member, now is a great time to become a member of the Majority Report. Support the show. Keep it alive. Make it so that it can become my primary job, so I can justify it more to my family. All right, folks, here's the interview, and we'll talk to you live tomorrow.
So, Bill, let's talk about first this the latest, I guess, I don't know how you would characterize it, but move by Bank of America, which looks to be putting taxpayers on the hook for a lot more of these crappy mortgages or crappy mortgage securities, I guess is more accurate. Tell us about this story.
So Bank America Corporation, BAC, the holding company, has a problem. It's been losing most of its value. In fact, since 2006, it's lost 88% of its shareholder value. That's about $480 billion. And, of course, it did so in large part because it acquired two really lousy entities that were involved in massive fraud and helped bring about this crisis. They were Countrywide, the most notorious lender in the world, and Merrill Lynch, one of the dumbest investment banks in the world. The game always is to move bad assets out of the holding company and into the insured institution in the hopes that the public will bail you out for your stupid decisions. And so Bank of America Holding Company has a ton of bad derivatives, probably especially things called credit default swaps, which are guarantees against losses. And the problem, of course, is it's nice to have a guarantee, but if the people can't pay on the guarantee, it's not worth as much. So as your credit rating of the person giving the guarantee goes down and down, other folks get nervous and they demand that you actually do things like post collateral to make sure you can actually pay on the guarantee. And if many people do that, you go into a death spiral. So Merrill Lynch is seeing its credit ratings, because they're part of Bank America Holding Company, go down and down and down. And people are starting to demand the posting of collateral, and that could cause them to tube. So they said, I know, why don't we transfer these crummy derivatives over to the insured institution, the bank called Bank of America, because they have a better credit rating because they're protected by the U.S. government. That's, after all, what deposit insurance and guarantees are. Now, that does put all of the U.S. government at greater risk of loss, because they're, you know, if those derivatives take money off the top, that's how they work. They get paid first, or very close to first. And that means there's less money left in the event that Bank of America goes glug, glug, glug. If there's less money left, fewer valuable assets, then the U.S. government has to pay for it instead.
Now, let me see. I mean, I have a separate question as to why Bank of America would have acquired Countrywide and Merrill Lynch. But so if I understand what you're saying correctly, Bank of America basically transfers these financial products into a different company that has a better credit rating because most of their assets are insured by the federal government. So in the event that Bank of America goes under, the creditors who have those who own those derivatives or own the sort of side bets on those derivatives will get paid first, leaving no more money for Bank of America to pay off its depositors, and that's how the federal government comes in and essentially subsidizes those owners of the derivatives.
That's correct, and the only confusion is you said Bank of America does this. It's actually the holding company, which is called BAC, because this is, of course, completely contrary to the interests of Bank of America. So one of the great questions is, wait a minute, who's the CEO? Doesn't he own, of the bank, he owes fiduciary duties to the bank, not to the holding company. Why would he ever agree to accept this crap from the holding company? And the answer is, of course, they do the bidding of the holding company. They don't do the bidding of their fiduciary duties.
And so is there not any type of government regulation that says when you have a federally insured institution, they cannot take on other obligations that are not federally insured if that money is fungible? In other words, the government is in effect, at least sort of in effect, insuring, in fact, those non-federally insurable products.
Right. So we're subsidizing, the U.S. government is subsidizing that. The key thing is not that they're not deposits. The key thing is that they're owned by an affiliate, right? And so we've known for 100 years that the game is to take the losses from the affiliates and to dump them into the insured entity. So indeed, we do have a rule against this. It's called 23A. And the problem is we've also got something called the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve regulates some banks directly, but mostly bank holding companies like Bank of America's holding company, BAC. So they identify with the interest of the holding company. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is the federal insurer that's on the hook. So they identify more with the interests of the American people. Guess which one won?
But how I can guess. I mean, it seems to be the way of the world these days. But I don't understand how that can happen. I mean, the Fed is not a government entity per se. The FDIC
is a government entity. I know people say other things, but it is a government regulatory agency.
Well, then how can it trump the 23A? I mean, isn't there, couldn't a, let's say, a depositor
in Bank of America? Or couldn't a taxpayer simply sue at this point because they're taking on obligations that legally they shouldn't have to take on?
Well, we probably wouldn't have standing as taxpayers is the more technical legal argument. But first, none of us can be surprised that government regulatory agencies headed by people who were picked because they are the leading anti-regulators in America, like Ben Bernanke, would not, in fact, enforce the rules, right? We just went through a crisis where they didn't enforce the rules. I mean, they allowed millions of loans to be made that the industry called liar's loans. So, no, we can have no assurance that the current crew of what Tom Frank aptly called the wrecking crew, you know, Bush's regulators, and many of whom Obama has actually promoted, will enforce the rules. Now, the second thing is, remember, what we're basing all of this on is a press leak. And the press leak almost certainly came from the FDIC, which despaired of its ability to block the Fed from doing this. And so it hoped that an aroused public would block this, and that's indeed should be the goal, I would think. But the Fed appears, again, it's a press leak, so we have to make guesses about it because it lacks a lot of details. But it appears that what the Fed did was to tell the holding company, you don't even have to file an application, just claim that it falls under an exemption from 23A and do the deal.
I guess the old adage, don't ask for permission, just apologize later and hope the taxpayers don't complain too much when they pick up the tab. We have to take a break, but when we come back, Bill, I want to talk about sort of the larger fraud that has taken place that led us to this financial crisis and get your perspective on it relative to your experience as a regulator from back in the 80s and 90s.
We'll
be right back after this. This is just, it's just stunning. I can't get over it. I've read this story and I couldn't wrap my head around it. I didn't understand how it could be, and I understand it now, and I still don't understand how it could be.
Well, that's good that you still have faith.
Yeah, I guess so. Hope springs eternal. All right, let's let's jump back in here. So, Bill, when we broke, you were telling us the horrible story. You told it well. It's still a horrible story of essentially the Fed dumping more responsibility for bank malfeasance or misfeasance, and probably some of both, upon the U.S. taxpayer. Just another mechanism in which we as taxpayers are on the hook to bail out banks for their bad decisions and for their fraud. But I want to take this a little bit more globally in how you see what took place leading up to 2008 until the financial crisis. The accountability that has existed afterwards, speaking as a former bank regulator.
Happy to, but I need to add one small little detail about how much money we're talking about, which is potentially some significant portion of $75 trillion. And trillion is 1,000 billion.
Now, this is $75 trillion is involved in what is that figure exactly?
Well, again, we don't know exactly. That is what's called a notional value. So that's, think of it as a gross. And some of it will be netted out. Maybe a lot of it will be netted out by, I have positions on both sides. But, of course, this actually ties to your next question, the death of accountability. The reason we don't know and have to guess is twofold. First, the passage of the Commodities Future Modernization Act of 2000. So once we had a real regulator, her name was Brooksley Bourne. She was head of the CFTC, Commodities Futures Trading Commission, and she warned back in 1998 and 9 and such that these credit default swaps could pose a terrible danger to the public and we needed regulation. And a bipartisan group of Republicans and Democrats, this is in the Clinton, the end of the Clinton administration, got together to squash Brooks Lyborn, including Alan Greenspan and Larry Summers and such, and, of course, the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan gang. So they not only, by passing this law, blocked a particular regulation to protect us against credit default swaps. The law removed all jurisdiction to pass any protective rules with regard to credit default swaps. In fact, it was so insane that it exempted credit default swaps from state anti-fraud provisions against bucket shops, which are completely fraudulent entities. That's how crazed this legislation is. And what it meant is we got not only no regulation, but because we couldn't regulate them, we couldn't even find the facts. So we don't know what the real positions are. Nobody knows. And, of course, the second part of that story, we now have a Dodd-Frank bill, and it allows some greater inquiries, but we still have the Bush's wrecking crew and the old Clinton wrecking crew, Larry Summers and Geithner and such, in charge. So none of them want to find out how bad, and they certainly don't want to tell us how bad it is. So this is that death of accountability. In the savings and loan crisis, to answer your question more.
Well, wait, before we move on to that comparison. So is the idea that if they can sort of shroud or continue to make the actual amount of money opaque to the rest of us, if they can continue to hide how much losses the banks have, if they can continue to sort of extend and pretend this idea that some of these banks are solvent or, you know, have balance sheets that would make us all, you know, turn white, that slowly they can just keep extracting money from the U.S. government, from the taxpayer, and from our economy until they are in sort of a more stable position? I mean, is that the game plan?
Well, that's if you were favorably disposed, what you would call the game plan.
Right.
Yes, the Geithner-Bernanke claim, of course, is they solved this entire crisis. It's over, remember. And they solved it at virtually no cost and vastly less cost, for example, than the savings and loan debacle. And therefore, it's rather inconvenient to their story that we actually have massive unrecognized losses, that we changed the accounting rules because of them and because of the industry so that the banks wouldn't have to recognize the losses. Why? So that they could pay the massive executive compensation that would otherwise have been blocked, would have been unlawful, unless we had gimmicked the accounting rules. It's accounting fraud, but it's legalized accounting fraud because they passed a statute on it and coerced the accounting groups to change the rules. So, yes, all of those games are being played, and that's, of course, it was credit default swaps that brought down AIG and cost the American people billions, but would have brought down much of the entire world financial system, but for some bailouts. And there's a new Inspector General report, by the way, on those that proves that the New York Fed deliberately overpaid on those guarantees in order to make entities like Goldman Sachs whole. When Goldman Sachs had key people on the New York Fed board of directors. So it is the slimiest of crony capitalism, fully worth of good old Indonesia and such days brought to the United States. And yes, Their claim is, oh, we had to do this for confidence, because you people, if we told you the truth, would have panicked. And so we hid the losses, and we're producing all kinds of behind-the-scenes government subsidies like this zero interest rate policy, all of which, of course, means that banks don't make productive investments much anymore.
Right.
They largely sit on their cash, and you don't get an economic recovery.
Right. I mean, why would you make loans to try and make money, which involves some measure of risk, when you can turn around and get someone to loan you money at 0% and know that the government, you can go, turn around and loan the government that same money at 1%, 2%, 3%, whatever it is the going rate is at that time. That's a surefire winner, isn't it?
Yeah, and we've even got a phrase in finance for it. That's called a risk-free arbitrage.
And so let me ask you this. All right, so we have this risk-free arbitrage going on, and so we know how the banks are essentially soaking us. And because when they loan the money to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government pays them back interest, you know, in the form of treasury bonds, let's say, that money is coming from taxpayers, either now or in the future. And so the other half of this coin is, of course, if we were to believe that all this needed to happen so that all of us little people would have confidence in our financial system and we wouldn't panic and, you know, cause runs on the bank or whatever it is that they were afraid that we would do, and that they needed to stabilize the system, there's another part of the equation, which is, okay, now that we've stabilized the system, are we going to hold those people who fundamentally destabilize the system accountable? And your experience is fairly telling in just how much we are not holding those people accountable.
That's right. And it's, again, part of this confidence fairy stuff, that we have to leave the frauds who looted their corporations, their banks, and caused this financial crisis, caused the Great Recession, cost roughly 10 million Americans their jobs or ability to get a job, cost, just counting the household sector, $11 trillion in loss of wealth. Again, a trillion is 1,000 billion. 11 of those 1,000 billions. We have to not only leave them in charge, we have to change the accounting rules so that they can get massive bonuses on fictional income, all because otherwise we'll have a crisis. So we have the following insane prescription, that the way to keep a stable economic system is to keep felons in charge of our largest, what we call systemically dangerous institutions, the top 20 banks. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And so based upon your experience in the savings and loan, I mean, how many people did people – I mean, I know that people went to jail. But give me a sense of just like sort of compare and contrast the numbers here.
So it all starts with the regulators again. Unless the regulators make the criminal referrals and do the heavy investigative work, you can't get significant prosecution successfully against these kinds of elite white-collar criminals. In the savings and loan days, the same agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, made over 10,000 criminal referrals, which produced over 1,000 felony convictions in cases designated as major by the Justice Department, and that understates the degree, because we worked with the Justice Department to create the top 100 list of the worst SNLs that translated into maybe 500 to 700 individuals. And so most of those successful felony prosecutions were against the most elite frauds. We had a 90% conviction rate against these folks, even though they have the best criminal defense lawyers in the world. And of course, money is no object for the CEOs in defending themselves against such a prosecution. In the current crisis, the same agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, made zero criminal referrals and of course produced zero convictions.
That's stunning.
So we now allow our most elite criminals to defraud and loot the banks with impunity, to cause the banks to fail, to have them to be bailed out by the government, to gimmick the accounting rules to hide the real losses so that they can pay themselves massive bonuses based on still more fictional income, and claim that the great danger is that anyone criticizes them, because that would be class warfare and pitting people against each other. And so you have right now this interesting political dynamic. The Obama administration is desperately putting pressure on the state attorney generals to create immunity as to even investigating their frauds. And there's a new column by Gretchen Morgenson about this in the New York Times. Right? This is a scandal of epic proportions. This is the official surrender of the United States to crony capitalism, the idea that we would give you, we won't even get the facts about how you looted. That's how much we will protect you.
And fortunately, guys like Eric Schneiderman have at least to this point said they're not going to go along with providing that immunity. But
and Joe Biden and Ms. Harris, the Attorney General of California. But, okay, think of this political dynamic. Against all kinds of alleged scandals, the Republican Party is, and their candidates, of course, but also their elected representatives, are decrying these scandals and demand, saying that they're going to have the most intense investigative hearings, et cetera, et cetera. Do you hear anything out of the Republicans about this scandal?
No, of course not.
To give immunity? So this is both parties.
Right.
And they won't even talk about it. They won't even discuss it as a political issue, or as an economic issue, or as an issue of morality. And it is fundamentally insane on both of their parts, the idea that we have to give a pass to the most elite frauds because they, in essence, have their finger on the economic button, and they will destroy us otherwise.
Well, Bill Black, we're out of time, but it's fascinating stuff, and I'd love to talk to you more about it in the near future.
Thank you. Look forward to it.